So I'd like to begin. I trust that your homework is done. And I'd like to ask you to begin by swapping your homework with someone else. The introductory information about yourself that you wrote down, give to some other student in the class and take from some other student in the class his information. Just swap it, break it out and swap it. Who didn't do their homework? Okay. Who did their homework? All right. You're in between, you did. You did? Why not? Okay, so if you didn't do it, make it up. Do it, because we're going to use it. It's going to be needed. Okay? We'll take a volunteer to give an introduction this morning. You get extra credit for volunteering. Okay, Adi Raj Prabhu. And you have someone's introduction?
Yes,
back there? Okay. So within a short time, a few minutes, I'll be asking you to speak. In subsequent classes, I won't be giving that few minutes because you'll already have the background in hand and you have overnight and over a few nights to think about it. But today, because you just got it, I'm giving a little space. Now, speaking, how to prepare. All right? How to prepare. The Karis emphasize that practically the most essential element in speaking is to be ready to speak, to have your preparation done, to have prepared and be ready. Now, what that consists of is not just compiling notes and going through books and having lots and lots of things that you can look at and read from. That's not what we mean by preparing. What we mean is that you've assimilated the subject matter, that you've thought about it, that it's cooked in your thoughts and in your being, so that you really have in your mind what this topic is all about, and now it's evolved to the point where you have something to say. You have something to say which is deeply felt and which is thought out. It's not incoherent, it's not, well, I kind of guess that maybe it would be like this, but I'm not quite sure. You definitely have reached conclusive ideas. Or you know that you haven't reached conclusive ideas, so you can get up and say with confidence, I don't know what this is all about, and I don't think you know what it's about either. None of us know what this is all about. We're confused. If that's what the case is. Okay, so we have to arrive at an assimilated state where we're ready to speak and actually burning to speak, desiring to speak. Alright? Now that, in our Krishna consciousness movement, should be the state in which we all are situated regularly. This brings us back to a theme that Tamal Krishna Maharaj was dealing with in his class, namely, that our purpose is to associate with the other devotees, here in Vrindavan, or wherever we are. This desire to speak, and competence or capability to speak, comes from being a Krishna conscious person. From cultivation.
What have I put most to myself? Yes.
From attending the classes, from associating with devotees, from following the regulative principles, and from preaching. That's how we become prepared. Not by reading Time magazine, not by material formulas, not by any trick, but by being solidly situated in Krishna consciousness. There's no substitute for that. That is our method. Now,
see if I have something specifically noted.
The points from Srila Prabhupada are there. How one becomes expert? By reading Srila Prabhupada's books, by assimilating these books, If you read them and assimilate them and discuss them with devotees and apply them, then you'll be full of topics to talk about. And you'll be wanting to talk about them. And you'll be seeing the need to talk to devotees and non-devotees for your own benefit and for their benefit. Then you'll be able to, you'll be prepared to speak not only upon invitation in advance, but at any moment you'll be prepared to speak about Krishna. Any questions? Adi Raj Prabhu. Ready? Thank you.
Just on behalf of all the members of our temple, I'd like to welcome everybody today. And just like to say a few words about our speaker. He's a very special devotee who's the exemplification of steadiness. This initiated disciple of Srila Satsarup Maharaj in 1980. And for the past 8 years, he's been serving very steadily the deities, Radha Govinda deities in New York Temple. And his service for the past few years has been cooking. He's been the head cook of the New York Temple. And he's well known for his Sunday feast, cooking for Rath Yatra festivals, and also preparing food for our Food for Life program. In fact, he's cooked over 150,000 meals for the Food for Life program alone. So, Janaka Prabhu, he's a, as you can see, an expert on cooking, quantity cooking. And for all of you who have come today to learn about cooking quantity, I'm sure there's a lot you can learn from him. Said he has been doing this very steadily for a number of years. He's also a well-rounded devotee, serving the deities when needed. He's also been involved with management, temple management. So he has a well-rounded perspective of what it means to be a devotee in Krishna consciousness. And he's used these qualities, especially for the past 2 years, especially in cooking. So I hope you can grasp onto something from what he has to say. And thank you very much, Shaka Prabhu.
Thank you.
This is a course start. On behalf of the audience of Vasudevan Kwanti, that is the book. And 50,000 is the work.
Feedback.
That was a nice start, nice middle, but a little weak on the end.
A little weak on the end?
Yeah.
Why?
A little too long.
Yes, why?
He was repeating some of the same things.
He'd already finished what he had to say. Mm-hmm. About two-thirds of the way through, you'd already reached the end of your talk. But somehow you felt obliged to continue. Unnecessarily. You had a very good natural conclusion. You explained Janaka's qualifications. Here's a person who's cooked for thousands of people, and you had good hard facts, the number of plates that he'd prepared. You had all of our interest. You brought it right down to the point that he's going to talk about this very subject in which he's so qualified. And then having reached that natural conclusion, you went on to some other point about how he's sort of a well-rounded devotee, he's worshipped the deities, he's done all sorts of other things. That's all of what should have been filtered out. It's interesting information, perhaps, for another talk. What it means to be a devotee. My career in ISKCON. Or many other possible topics. But for this particular topic, you already had reached the end, and then you kept going. That's something that we all do. And it's something that we'll be spotting in our talks and trying to learn to hone in on. We reach our conclusion and we stop. Other points? Vegavan Prabhu.
You mentioned yesterday about some of the mistakes we do. Like, he's very expert, so therefore listen very carefully.
Yes.
That was what I was doing.
Yes. I'm sure you'll be able to get something from it. These are vagaries. And they're not backed up by anything, really. You're just saying, so we should... They're tag-ons. There's something you heard somebody say and you think that you should also say it. Don't. He didn't know what he was doing. Whoever said that the first or second or third or fourth time, you just pulled it out of the can. Leave it in the can. Can it. Other comments? I have one also that you began with a couple of vagaries. He's a very special devotee. He's sort of this and that. The speech could have been two-thirds shorter by that. Don't warm up with anything. He's a very special devotee and this and that. And don't end up with a sort of rounded out. He's a very special devotee or a very well-rounded devotee or a very good devotee. Just cut it down to what you really want to get across. Pull out the essence, deliver it, and stop. Yes?
Is it a mistake to state the person's name last?
No, not necessarily, but I was very glad that Adiraj didn't do that. Right in the middle, he identified the speaker. It could have been at the beginning, but it was fine right where he mentioned it. And it's usually a mistake to mention it last. It's sometimes a very effective thing to do. When it's really somebody astounding, when we're really going to be surprised, when you've brought all the way from China our first Chinese devotee and nobody even knows that he came. When it's going to be a real punchline, then save it till last and deliver it and leave them completely surprised. Otherwise, everybody knows who it is after your first five words. They just heard that Janaka was cooking in New York Temple because it was mentioned in Tamal Krishna Maharaj's class. So we all know who you mean. Why should you hold his name and keep us in artificial suspense that we're not in? No need. So usually it's a mistake, yes. Another point?
I'm not surprised you're saying that practically when everyone knows who it is, but they don't know that he's there. They know the story.
In other words, when you have a definite purpose, when it's really going to be the most effective ending for your little introduction, when the audience really doesn't know who it's going to be, they really can't tell by hearing you, and then at the end, there's a special punch that comes by saying that you've brought such and such person to speak. Otherwise, no need. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States has come to Vrindavan. Then if you save it till last, it's fine. Any other points? Okay. So we're moving on. Diction. I want to discuss phenomenon. In 26 Second Avenue, when Srila Prabhupada was there, there was a little group of devotees, and they all developed great affection for Srila Prabhupada. They had the advantage of Srila Prabhupada's personal, intimate association day after day. And one of the things that happened was that they started speaking like Srila Prabhupada. And it was a sort of a pleasure, very consciously done, that with a little gleam in your eye, you'd say something the same way that Srila Prabhupada had said it, and everyone would exchange a kind of transcendental ecstasy, remembering Srila Prabhupada and how Srila Prabhupada would speak. Very consciously, we deliberately disobey the laws of grammar, disobey the laws of English pronunciation, to speak as Srila Prabhupada had.
Can you give an example?
Yes. I'd say in a lecture, so the living entity, Krishna is infinite, and we are infinite simile. Yes, we're infinite simile. Or infinite simile.
Srila Prabhupada would say it both ways.
So that's very charming when Srila Prabhupada would say it. And for those who were familiar with it, it's charming to be reminded of it. It's a pleasure to be reminded of it. But when it just becomes a part of ISKCON standard speech, and we're speaking to an audience that knows nothing about Srila Prabhupada, it comes off as strange as hell. Utterly weird. Or just uneducated. This person doesn't know how to speak English. Whenever Srila Prabhupada spoke, he spoke perfectly. For him to speak just as a Bengali gentleman visiting America, learning how to speak in the native colloquial way, was charming. It added to the attractiveness of his message. It added. But when we young Americans and Europeans speak like Indians, it's strange, it's weird, it's affected, it's distracting. Don't do it. Your English should be like Prabhupada's Bengali. Prabhupada spoke the most refined Bengali language. And we should strive in our English to present Srila Prabhupada's message in the same refined voice.
Maharaj, what about devotees who preach in English but in India?
That's a special case. If you're preaching in India, you sometimes have to adopt a little different speech pattern, because then so many of the people who've learned English in India have learned it not from English-speaking people, native English-speaking people, but from other Indians who've learned from other Indians who've learned from other Indians. And so they won't understand easily when you speak like a native New Yorker. They'll understand when you speak in the way they've learned. We're that way also. I can understand Hindi better when an American speaks it than when an Indian speaks it. Because that American is speaking in a slow, very overemphasized sort of way that I could understand. Whereas the Hindi, native Hindi speaker is just rattling off language that he'll understand and any other native Indian Hindi speaker will understand. So we foreigners here in India sometimes have to change our pattern of stress for speaking to Indians. However, sometimes we overdo it, and it becomes strange also, even to the Indians. You're speaking to some perfectly educated Bombay businessman and saying why he should do like this. And the perfectly educated Bombay businessman is thinking to himself, why is he speaking this way? Why is he turning his words backwards? So we don't have to imitate all the peculiarities of imperfectly learned Indian English in order to be understood. And we falsely do it and overdo it. Mainly we have to change our pronunciation a little bit and make it clear and slow and distinct. That's the main thing. If you're slow enough and clear enough and distinct enough, then people will understand you. Yes?
Mistake about to take a kind of condescending air.
It certainly does.
You could only understand third grade talking, so that's what I'm talking to you.
Yes. Yes. And particularly that's true when we're abroad, when we're dealing with Indian people who are resident abroad and who adopted all the local patterns of speech. When we come from India and start preaching to them in our affected pseudo-Indian English. It's very weird.
I was at the passport office in New York, and there was some big tumult at the window. People were wanting to get things done quickly. And the Indian man behind the desk says, "Stop giving me such a hard time, man." Like that.
Right.
You took the whole thing right out.
Yes.
Mark, would you say that the use of syntax in the way that devotees turn it around is actually due to the fact that Indian people are trying to assimilate the English language into the form of syntax that they use in Bengali? Is that a fact?
You mean how it gets that way?
Yeah. Because I've noticed that with Spanish. The only way.
Yes, sometimes it's like that. For example, I don't know. What's a good example? I can't think of an example right now. But yes, very often what you hear in English is the perfectly proper way to say the thing in Hindi or Bengali, and just translate it word for word. So it's following, yes, the standard syntax of the native language. Yeah, anyone who's learning a language does that. But if you grew up with the language, if you were born with the language, why should you do that? And if you go to any ISKCON temple and attend the Bhagavatam class, you'll hear so many times English language bent completely out of shape by native English speakers who know better, who grew up and to the age of 18 or 20 or 25 speaking perfectly straight English, and in the last 3 to 5 years in our little ISKCON society have turned it upside down and backwards. Some other point? Since I've referred to it a couple of times, we'll deal with our first anomaly. These are all anomalies, which is words backwards. Questions call for inverted word order. Subject, verb, object. That's standard order. That's inverted order. Subject has been placed here. Right? That's what you do when you ask a question in English. You invert the word order. Why should I do this? Not. It's wrong. For everyone else but Srila Prabhupada, it's wrong. Don't do it. Invert your word order the way you always used to do before you joined this. One more. There's one more word that brings about inverted word order. We can say this. Good English sentence. But if you put before it, the word nor, then it inverts. Nor can we say this. Right? That's standard English. The word that you never put at the beginning of a sentence like that is neither or neither. Neither we can do this. Neither we can tolerate this. Neither I shall go, neither you shall go. It's all wrong. It's all bogus. First of all, neither goes with nor. Neither this nor that. It doesn't stand alone. So it's called a correlative pronoun. They come in pairs. Neither this nor that. Neither here nor there.
It doesn't stand alone. What stands alone is Nora. And when it does, it inverts the word order. Clear?
Sure it is. We all used to do it.
Okay. These will classify us, these errors, as illiterates. Speakers of the highest philosophy should not come off illiterate. Okay.
Maharaj, what's an example of using neither correctly with that phrase?
Neither? We can say that we have neither the time nor the energy to spend on material welfare work. We have neither men nor money.
And with this phrase, can we say?
Nor, we can say neither this nor that. Neither Atmananda nor I shall do this. Or, I shall not leave this temple today. Nor shall I eat. I shall not leave this temple today, nor shall Atmananda. Neither nor. They go together. Any other points or questions? Arguments. When we speak of an argument, we mean any sort of disagreement. Any sort of disagreement, difference of opinion. From a polite discussion of something to a knockdown, drag-out fight. That's an argument. Another meaning of argument is your specific line of reason or unreason, as the case might be. I have a position, point of view, and I give my various arguments, my evidence or my lines of reason to support my conclusion. That's also an argument, just to define our terms. Now, arguments, disagreements, can be of two kinds. One is creative. In a creative argument, you're not attached to any particular point of view, but you're discussing it, looking at it from different angles of vision. And at the end, both you and the person that you're speaking with, or the others that you're speaking with, will come out having explored the subject matter, and you'll all be happy with the results of your discussion. Because the purpose of the discussion is not to win over anyone to a particular point of view, but just to explore the various angles of vision or the contention that's come before you. Creative argument. Another kind of argument is an attached argument. You've got something at stake. You've got something at stake. Maybe you're arguing about how much your devotee maintenance check should be. Or maybe you're the president arguing with someone about how much his devotee maintenance check should be. Maybe you're arguing about so many different topics in which you feel strongly and you're not prepared to budge. You have a purpose also. Your purpose is to win. Your purpose is to win. Get the other guy to agree to your point of view. Attached argument. You're attached to your own conclusion. Now, we should know, we should be able to make a distinction between the two. We should be able to recognize how attached we are to the conclusion and how much attached our opposer is to his conclusion. If he's very attached, and we're not attached, back off. Back off. Because you're just going to get in a big argument with him. You're going to get his hair standing on end. And you're really just going to be playing games with him because you don't care one way or the other. And he does. You're only irritating him. What is it in Bhagavad Gita? One should avoid speech which is agitating to others. Austerity of speech. Anudvega karambakyam. One should not speak in such a way as to agitate others. So if someone's very attached and you're not, give in. Give some space. Be generous. Now, sometimes it's better not to argue. Argument we're dealing with here, but argument is not necessarily the best way to deal with any situation. It's a tool. It's an approach. It's an item in your repertoire of preaching. When necessary, you're prepared to argue. Sometimes argument is the least effective way to deal with a situation. Sometimes it's better simply to sit and listen and tolerate whatever nonsense the person says. Sometimes that's simply better. Sometimes you know that the person's such a fool, he's not going to listen to any good argument, so you just tolerate for a few moments and give him prasadam. Sometimes argument is foolish. Prasadam is a better idea. Sometimes kirtan is a better idea. Sometimes walking away is a better idea. And sometimes argument is the best. So you should be discriminating and not be carried away. There's an injunction in Shastra. One should not indulge in arguments and counter-arguments. Nor should one take shelter of any cause or faction. Vadavaram chajeti tarkan paksham kamsha nasam shriyet. Seventh canto. Particularly, it's an instruction for sannyasis, but for anyone who's renounced materialistic life. Here's the instruction. Don't develop an argumentative attitude, purport. Of course, those who preach sometimes need to argue with the contentions of opponents, but as much as possible, one should avoid an argumentative attitude. It's unattractive. It's obnoxious. A person who's always arguing. It's called a polarity response in psychology. As soon as someone says he's from this pole, then you say, well, I'm from that pole. If he says it's white, you say, well, I don't think so. It looks black to me. It's an argumentative attitude or an argumentative habit. And it's contrary to the heart of a devotee. It doesn't help in devotional service. Nectar of Devotion is still here. Is there a copy?
Yes. I got one here.
Chapter we were reading. For persons who have a natural taste for understanding books like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, devotional service is easier than for those who are simply accustomed to mental speculation and argumentative processes. To support this statement, there are many authoritative assertions by learned scholars. And there's a discussion of how one person establishes his conclusion, another person defeats it, another person establishes it. So one can't learn the truth by argument, nor should one be overly addicted to argument, either for understanding or for convincing others. Two mistakes. First is, I try to understand the truth just by argument. And not quite as bad, but sufficiently obnoxious. I try to convince others by argument when it's simply not the best approach. Some examples. Rupa Goswami, I gave that example yesterday. He just signed the man's paper and said, all right, you beat me. But then what happened? The man met Jiva Goswami. Arguer said, well, you know, I just met your uncle.
defeated him. Here's the paper. Jiva Goswami said, let me see that paper. Then Jiva Goswami took him on, and Prabhupada said, practically killed him with arguments. Practically slaughtered him with arguments. Jiva Goswami is the most brilliant philosopher, and he's just being appreciated now. He's being discovered by the Western philosophers. What a brilliant exponent of philosophy Jiva Goswami was. Logic and philosophy, so he slaughtered the man with arguments and said, next time, deal with the disciple first, and then you can see about dealing with the master. So he's criticized by the sahajas also, that instead of being a pure devotee, instead of amanina, amanadina, he just had an argumentative attitude and he wasn't humble like Rupa Goswami. Srila Prabhupada said, no, he was right. To defend the honor of Krishna or the spiritual master, we're at once prepared to argue. So both Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami knew when to argue and when not to argue.
In this case, in defending Krishna as a spiritual master, what category of argument would that come under? Attached.
We are not, I'm not at all saying that a creative argument is superior to an attached argument. Generally, when we're speaking with non-devotees, our arguments are attached arguments. They are attached arguments. We have a conclusion, and we are attached to it. We are convinced that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that devotional service is the only means to reach Krishna. That only by chanting Hare Krishna can one be successful in this age for Krishna consciousness or spiritual perfection. We are attached. We are attached. So one argument doesn't work, we try the next one. We don't give in. We're completely attached. Attached on it. And sometimes when we speak with other devotees, we're very attached. But sometimes that attached argument is not necessary. What are we attached to? Sometimes we're attached to the philosophy. But sometimes what we have at stake is not the philosophy, it's our false ego. It's our false pride. What matters is not what the argument is, what the subject matter is, but who we're arguing with. Is he above me? Is he below me? How do I perceive what he's trying to do to me or what I'm trying to do to him? Or who are we arguing in front of? Especially arguing in the presence of women. That'll do it every time. Or in the presence of younger persons who look up to us. We don't want to lose an argument. So we're attached. Even when we're wrong, we go on arguing. And we won't give in. False, needlessly attached. Stubborn. So know when to be attached and when to be detached. As far as possible, we're detached. Except when it comes to Krishna. When it comes to the service of Krishna, we're completely attached. And when it comes to some other subject matter, then the injunction is, don't take sides. Don't become a member of a faction. Be detached. Be open. But don't budge even a fraction of an inch from the determination of devotional service. Attached arguments can get nasty. They turn into name-calling, spitting, mean disagreements, permanent grudges, bad blood develops that goes on for years. Don't develop attached arguments with devotees over needless disagreements. Develop loving relationships with devotees. Then, nectar of instruction. We exchange our views with devotees. We reveal our mind to devotees. We listen as other devotees reveal their minds to us. We keep in mind what our real relationship is. That I'm part and parcel of Krishna. This person is also part and parcel of Krishna. He's serving Krishna. So what, out of millions, manusyanam sahasreshu, kaschid yadavi siddhaya,
and yadatamapi siddhanam krishnamam devita. Out of thousands and millions of persons, someone comes to devotional service, and then when he comes, and when we come, we argue with him over trifles. Why? It's due to our bad nature. It's due to passion and ignorance. What is that? Tadā rājas tamo bhāva kāma lobha cetā etairanā vidham stitam sattvēn deceived. As we come to the mode of goodness, then we become very soft and very pleasing. That's the symptom of a person whose speech is in the mode of goodness. His speech is pleasing to others. If you look in discussion of the modes of material nature, you'll find that one of the characteristics of the persons in the mode of passion and ignorance is that they're expert at insulting others. They've made this an art in modern materialistic society, what's called the artful put-down. You find a real sharp way to criticize the other person. And the audience appreciates how you got them, how you insulted him in a very suave or very sophisticated or very clever way. And then if he can insult you back, then it's touche, and everyone's pleased with that. Oh, this is animal society. This is animal society. As soon as we meet, I insult you and you insult me, and we take kind of pleasure in it. We should cultivate Krishna consciousness and loving dealings in the So for that we have to be detached. We have to be purified persons. And for that this argumentative mentality is so obstructive. I know we have some devotees in Vrindavan who have that mentality, and it hurts their devotional service so badly. Persons who are very sane and very good and very dedicated, austere, they have many, many good qualities, but they just can't give up fighting. Arguing, factionalizing, dividing, politicizing. It's so obstructive to their own Krishna consciousness. Then they become angry. They churn themselves up. And then they make others angry. And then when they meet others, then it's forgotten what this person's service is, what nice things he's doing, how much he's surrendered, and how much, all that, he just becomes identified with the causes that he's become attached to needlessly, with the argumentative mentality that's developed within him. So we sometimes need to be attached, and sometimes it may mean that we get even nasty or unpleasant to deal with because we refuse to compromise our principles. People don't like it. If you stick to your principles and refuse to budge, then people will consider you obstinate sometimes, and they'll dislike you for it. But when we have a principle that we're determined to follow, because it's our duty, we shouldn't compromise. We shouldn't budge from the order of the spiritual master. Be obnoxious. That's fine. And actually people will respect you. To be milk toast, to be lukewarm, it's not everybody's milk toast and lukewarm. Everyone's compromising with everybody else to be popular and to be liked or to be accepted. But you'll be respected more if you stick by your guns, if you're actually sticking on Krishna's side. And there's a quotation, Jastu Panduputra Anam Yakshe Paksha Janardana. Victory is on the side of the Pandavas, on whose side Krishna is. So if we stick to Krishna's side, victory is certain. Otherwise, be flexible. Some other points? Yes?
When I think of argument, at least some technique to learn, or something. I always think of argument in the sense of speaking to a non-devotee, trying to convince him, or trying to put a chink in the armor of his false philosophy, so you can come to the point of conclusive knowledge of Krishna consciousness. So when I think of arguing, I don't really think of it in a belligerent way, but more of like an artful technique of trying to elevate someone. Now, they don't really have much to stand on. It's not like a he has as much artillery as I do, or as a devotee would have, you know. But is argument, is that also considered argument, or is that more like in a logic category?
Well, argument means any disagreement. From a polite discussion to a knockdown, drag-out fight. So when we have some disagreement, the materialistic person has some disagreement. I'm not prepared to surrender to Krishna. I don't see why I should surrender to Krishna. I think you guys are making a mistake surrendering to Krishna. So then we have to present our reasons. We have to present our arguments. We present logic, we present evidence, we present examples, we present Shastra quotations. Just to convince the person, he should change his position. He should go from being a non-devotee to being a Krishna devotee. He should go from not chanting Hare Krishna to chanting. From not coming to the temple to coming. From not following the regular principles to following. These are all arguments, disagreements. And we present our different lines of reasoning. That's what we mean by argument. Well, argument is not bad. Argument is one of our processes.
Fact-wise.
And we should use it skillfully. That's our recurring theme. That all of whatever we do, we should do skillfully. We should also argue skillfully. And as we go through the different lessons, you'll find many arguments, many methods of argument you can use, or many methods of false argument that you can cut down. So that's, as we learn them, we become more skillful in argument for the service of Krishna. But first skill of argument is to size up what's going on. Am I attached, or doesn't it matter to me? Is the person with whom I'm speaking attached, or does it matter to him? Is he right, or am I right? Or is it possible that I could be wrong? What kind of argument are we having? Who is he? Is he the visa official? Number two man at the consulate in New York? Maybe I shouldn't argue with him on this particular point. Last time I was in New York, the consul general was prepared to give me a 3-month entry visa. And I wanted a 1-year entry visa. And the person who applied was prepared to argue with the man over the length of the visa. But the fact was, first of all, the 3-month entry visa was perfectly enough for me. And second of all, that the man was following the standard procedure that his job obliged him to follow. So arguing simply would have antagonized an important man whom we want to engage again and again and again for helping us in Krishna consciousness, and it wouldn't have gotten me a longer visa anyway. So sizing up the situation, one looks and says, Mr. Agarwal, thank you very much. Bless. No further argument. This just means beating your head against the wall, antagonizing the person, getting yourself angry, and not getting any result. That's a good time not to argue. Sometimes the best policy is not to argue at all, just to accept. Another point? Question? Okay.
What is Paramatma? What is Bhagavan? Vikshaku Prabhu, you can speak on this topic for... You spoke yesterday? You did. Someone else should speak. Okay. Yeah. Tell me your name. No.
Krishnaksha.
The Krishnaksha group. Why don't you speak on this topic for 4 minutes? Yeah, come to the room. Every day, aside from introductions, whenever I get time, and gradually the time will be extended for this purpose, I'll be asking you to speak not only introductions of one another, but also exposition of various topics. And you'll also have the opportunity to get feedback.
Okay, I'd like to explain today the different aspects on
Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Okay, these are three aspects of in realization of God. Okay, so Brahman can be compared to the rays of the sun. If we have the sun, okay. So can I take that over again?
You got yourself this far. Get yourself
okay.
Further.
Brahman is the effulgence coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Brahman is the realization that everything comes from God. Now, Paramatma is a localized aspect of God. He's in every living entity, you know, beside the soul, within the heart of every human being, of every plant or other living entity. Now, Bhagavan is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the source of this localized aspect, Paramatma, and also the source of Bhagavan. So, is everything clear? Does anyone have any questions?
Okay, thank you. Feedback? I'll give you some feedback, first of all. You can relax. Our audience, despite its appearance, is not hostile. So, relax. Bhagavan Prabhu, you wanted to say something.
If it's an audience that doesn't know philosophy, it would be quite confusing.
Pardon me?
I thought it was a little confusing. If it's not an audience that's familiar with the subject.
How would you make any suggestion that would make it clearer?
Yeah. Start off by examining the word God, or you know, and how it can be realized. It's a common misunderstanding, and can be actually realized in three different ways. You can focus in on God successively.
Sort of jumped right into the middle of the subject, presuming too much knowledge on the part of the hearer. Okay.
I was just going to say, just to set a foundation first before, but I was going to say this.
Okay. The same suggestion, set a sort of frame.
I'll describe the practitioner. I'll describe it, you know, at least set a premise for the desire for stabilization. For those people who are seeking God, there are, you know, it seems as though it's like a starting point.
Any other comments? Vasudev Prabhu?
I think it's really too bad he gave up the idea of giving this analogy of the sun. Because that would have introduced the theme, and then you would have said exactly.
Of course, there are many, many ways to discuss any subject. I could give one comment, that is that it's good that you used your hands. Your hands were not locked in front of you, that you were able to use them expressively. That's a very good qualification.
He spoke very clearly so I can understand everything he said. And it seemed like he had thought things out fairly previous to speaking to my mother.
Considering that I gave him about 40 seconds, I think he did. Vasudev Prabhu, I have a question. Is it possible that a time could be available when people could view their own talks? Oh, these classes are being videotaped, and you can take advantage of reviewing your own talks. I'm going to do that too. I want to see how I'm giving these classes. I'm going to do an extensive review. So I would recommend this. I think that by seeing how you're speaking, you'll get something. You'll be your own critic and your own advisor. Now we'll really end.